Good day. Today is Saturday, 29th November 2025, and before I proceed with this programme, let me again remind you to tick the like button if once you've watched this programme or whatever part of this programme you want to watch, you've liked what you've heard, and you decide that you want to indicate that fact. Let me now turn to the events of the last 24 hours, and of course the big news over the last 24 hours is that Zelensky's once all-powerful chief of staff, the man many people believed was the true power in Ukraine, Andrei Yermak, has been forced to resign. And the events that took place played out over the course of yesterday. Firstly, he gave, or at least there was published, a long article which Yermak gave to Simon Schuster for The Atlantic. In this, he basically gave the usual uncompromising position that the Zelensky government, backed by its European allies, has taken about the conflict in Ukraine and about the various proposals for negotiations leading to a peace settlement with Russia. Anyway, there was speculation that the United States, the government of the United States, President Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, other officials in Washington were angry with the uncompromising tone of this interview, and presumably that they gave some kind of instruction to investigators from NABU and SAPO, the two Western-funded anti-corruption agencies in Kiev, and that the investigators from these two agencies then responded by raiding Yermak's house, searching for, well, it's still not clear to me what, taking away with them, again, I'm not sure what, but within a few hours later, the word was out that Zelensky had accepted his resignation. Yermak has made a defiant statement since. He says that he is a decent person, that all of the allegations that have been made against him are untrue, and that he now intends to serve Ukraine by joining the military and going to fight at the front line. Whether he does so, of course, we will have to wait and see. Anyway, that is what Yermak has said. Now, inevitably, there's going to be very much speculation as to what has brought this about. And, of course, this is clearly an outgrowth of the larger corruption scandal that has been underway in Ukraine for a number of weeks now, which started when Zelensky's friend, Timur Mindich, who seems to have played a central role in the corruption scandal, though perhaps not a pivotal role. Anyway, he fled. He's widely believed to be in Israel, and all sorts of recordings, tape recordings, have been circulating, which appear to show top Ukrainian officials and other people cynically talking about the best ways to steal money, some of the money that is being provided, presumably by the West, and to enrich themselves. Things, of course, which, if you had been following us on the Duran, Alex Christoforou and me, you would long have known were already happening. And, of course, we are far from being the only people who have been discussing this. You will find much commentary and discussion of it in alternative or independent media. But, of course, for some people in the West, no doubt this has come as a surprise. And for some people in the Ukraine and Kiev itself, it has come as a shock. Not a shock, not because they were surprised that this sort of thing was taking place. I doubt that there is anybody in Ukraine who doesn't know that something of this kind has been taking place. Rather, that NABU and SAPO, after years of, well, quiescence, because that's just about the correct way to describe them, events in Ukraine, the Substack page with that name, has discussed Nabu's complete inability to secure a single conviction over the course of its entire existence up to now. Anyway, the real shock, I suspect, for many people in Ukraine is that Nabu and Sapo were finally doing their jobs and were generally investigating corruption and taking action against the people who were engaged in that corruption. Even though I suspect, this being Ukraine, everybody is utterly cynical about the reasons behind it. I, of course, entirely share that cynicism. I don't believe that there is any part of the Ukrainian political system in Kiev which is free of corruption. There are perhaps a few individuals who are, perhaps Mariana Bezuglaya, for example, whom I've talked about many times. She does not impress me as a corrupt person, but then, of course, I don't know very much about her, and I might be wrong even about her. But that doesn't change the fact that the entire system, from top to bottom, is corrupt and has been so. And, of course, the corruption existed on a massive scale before the Maidan coup, or revolution, if you prefer, in February 2014. The former president, Viktor Yanukovych, was definitely corrupt. And so was his son, and so were other officials who served in his government. And there was corruption extending all the way back to the moment that Ukraine became independent of the Soviet Union. And I've heard stories, by the way, that Ukraine was corrupt, or at least some people in Ukraine were corrupt. A lot of people in Ukraine were corrupt, even before Ukraine became independent of the Soviet Union. But my strong sense has been, and I have reasons to believe this, which I'm not going to go into in this program, but my own strong belief is that the corruption got much worse after 2014, that the collapse of the previous government, the Yanukovych government, essentially led to a collapse of Ukraine's institutions, including its law enforcement institutions, and of course also led to a major inflow of Western money. The result was an increase in corruption. And of course things have got stratospherically worse since the war began in February 2022, when the Western money flows multiplied in scale, and the proceeds of corruption inevitably were going to make people very, very much richer than they had previously been. So anyway, there we go. That's no doubt the story. As I said, I don't believe that this is just about corruption. I accept that there is obviously a power play involved here. I am not as sure as many people are that the United States is behind this. There's a few things to say here. Firstly, it is no secret that the United States has been tired of Yermak for some time. I think it was in Politico that an article appeared a few months ago which said that the United States has had it with Yermak and that they would like to see him go. And there are reports that US officials have tried to persuade Zelensky to remove Yermak at various times. So I'm not suggesting that the Americans have not wanted him to go and might not be happy to see him go. I'm not sure whether it is quite as straightforward as someone in Washington, J.D. Vance, CIA Director Ratcliffe, someone in the FBI or Cash Patel, perhaps. Anyway, someone in Washington simply picking up the phone and calling Nabu and saying, we don't like this article that Yermak has just given to the Atlantic. So please go round, raid his house, find what you can there and engineer his removal. I'm not saying that that sort of thing doesn't happen. And I'm not saying that it is completely impossible. There's just a few points, however, that I would make. Firstly, as I understand it, since USAID was shut down earlier this year, NABU and SAPO have not been funded by the United States. They have been funded by the European Union. So the United States does not have the tight control over NABU and SAPO that it once did. And moreover, my understanding is that American control of NABU and SAPO was historically exercised by the embassy, the US embassy in Kiev. And from what I've heard, the embassy in Kiev, the US embassy in Kiev, is currently itself in the process of a rather disruptive transition. A few weeks ago, the ambassador, the US ambassador to Ukraine, the long-standing US ambassador to Ukraine, who had been a fervid supporter of Zelensky's and of Ukraine's cause, and who had been appointed, I believe, during the time of Biden's administration. Anyway, she resigned. I'm not certain whether there is a replacement who has taken her position. And anyway, I understand that there's been considerable disruption and turnover of positions within the embassy, and instability about what it's doing and what its exact role in the new Trump administration is. So, well, I'm not saying that these are unanswerable obstacles to the Americans engineering this event, this latest event. No doubt if the Americans did put pressure on NABU and SAPO to come after Yermak, they would probably still have done that. But I'm not sure that it is quite as straightforward and as simple as people suppose. One thing I will say is that if it was indeed the Americans who engineered Yermak's removal yesterday, then that almost certainly was not connected to the interview Yermak gave to Simon Schuster and The Atlantic, which, as far as I could see, was largely boilerplate stuff, the sort of things that Yermak and other Ukrainian officials regularly say. Far more likely, what would have worried and angered the Americans was the announcement from Kiev that Yermak was going to lead the Ukrainian delegation that is coming to the United States, to Miami, in fact, in a few days, to meet with Witkoff and Kushner there in order to discuss in advance Witkoff's and Kushner's trip to Moscow and their meetings with the Russians and specifically with Putin. And I can well imagine that the Americans, who have long since come to view Yermak as the man who is one of the people who is the most obstructive in any settlement negotiations with the Russians, and the man who has had very close ties with the Europeans, they might not take it well that he had been appointed to head this delegation to the United States at this critical time. Having said that, to repeat again, I am not 100% convinced that the Americans played a decisive role or were even necessarily involved. As to the other major party, the European Union, it's extremely unlikely that they were involved also, despite the fact that they are the people who now write the checks for NABU and SAPO, because they made it absolutely clear what they think of this entire investigation, this entire corruption investigation. They don't like it. The European Union ambassadors, as I know for an absolute fact, told the Ukrainians some days ago that they wanted the corruption investigations to be put on hold. At this particular time, with the Trump administration pushing for a negotiated outcome of the conflict in Ukraine, which goes beyond what the European Union wants to see, and with the United States making proposals about the frozen Russian assets, which cut completely across the European Commission's and the German government's wish to use those assets as collateral for a 140 billion euro loan to be provided to Ukraine. The Europeans do not want, or did not want, any disruption or instability in Kiev or anything to happen in Ukraine which might undermine the stability and authority of the Zelensky government, to which they have extremely unwisely and recklessly fully committed themselves to. So the Europeans have already said that they did not want this investigation to be pressed forward at this time. And in fact, shortly after news came out of Yermak's resignation, forced resignation, a senior Polish official, I believe it was Foreign Minister Sikorski, actually said that this was that this is not good news. It was not good news for Ukraine. And by extension, it's not good news for the European Union either. I would, by the way, add at this point that there are other people in Ukraine itself, in Kiev, who have also been following the message from Brussels to put these investigations on hold. And, well, they've been going out saying and publishing articles in the Ukrainian media, putting messages on X, saying that, again, this is not the time to pursue investigations, anti-corruption investigations. What is much more important is the war and success in the war, supposedly. And for that reason, the investigations should be put on hold so that Zelensky and Yermak and these nice people can continue their job. They don't say what their job, that the job is stealing money from Ukrainians, but anyway, one understands what they mean. So the Europeans don't want this investigation to proceed. The Americans probably would like to see Yermak go, but I'm not absolutely sure that they were actually behind it. I think a lot of people who discuss this internal scandal in Ukraine overlook the fact that there is a political crisis underway in Ukraine already. And the best discussion of this has come from Strana, which is a dissident Ukrainian newspaper, or magazine rather, website, which is now published outside Ukraine. They write, I believe, in Ukrainian and Russian. And I'm taking these extracts from this article from the translation generously provided to me by the British historian Jeff Roberts. And first of all, Strana acknowledges that this is a major blow for Zelensky himself. And then it says this: the head of the presidential office, Andrei Yermak, was a key figure in Zelensky's inner circle. Although Yermak will likely try to maintain his control by appointing a close associate as the new head of the office, I wonder whether that is possible, by the way. His resignation ultimately sets in motion Zelensky's loss of control over the vertical of power, in other words, the political structures. Yermak was actually fired not by his boss, Zelensky, but by Nabu. Even before he was charged, the president dismissed his closest associates, following only a search public outcry and pressure from opposition politicians, and we will come to that in a moment. And Stranar continues, this sends a powerful signal to the entire state apparatus that Zelensky is no longer the source of power in the country and cannot guarantee anything, even to his closest associates. Few believe that Yermak could, and like Mindich and other figures in high ranking corruption cases, could have carried out their schemes without the knowledge, consent, or even direct participation of the president. I am one of those people who does not believe that Zelensky has clean hands and was not aware of what was going on. I think that is unbelievably naive, and I don't for one moment think it. And Stranar continues, a blow to Zelensky is therefore automatically, a blow to Yermak is therefore automatically a blow to Zelensky, a signal that he too could be accused of corruption at any moment, especially if lesser figures speak out, and after today's events, that likelihood has increased. In other words, if people who are involved in these corruption schemes, in order to try to protect themselves, come out and start providing evidence against Zelensky, then his position becomes extraordinarily insecure. And given that Zelensky was unable to protect Yermak, that may mean that some of these people who were involved in this corruption, in order to protect themselves, might be more likely to do this. And then Stranar discusses what might happen to Zelensky. It says that these immediately after the outbreak of the scandal, Zelensky began to lose his levers of political control within the government. Even the Prime Minister, Sviridenko, who, by the way, is a protege of Yermak's, has begun to rely increasingly on the opinions of the Servant of the People faction. That's the government party, rather than the office of the prosecutor general, and of the president, which is of course means ultimately Yermak. And the article continues, the SBU, that's Ukraine's major counterintelligence and intelligence agency, and the prosecutor general's office also began to sabotage various political instructions from the president's office, in other words, from Yermak and from Zelensky. Now all these processes will accelerate dramatically. The only question is, how will Zelensky lose his remaining power? And then the article continues by suggesting that the preferred option of at least some of the plotters, and we'll come in a moment to who those plotters might be. Anyway, that the preferred option is to keep Zelensky in office as president, but to reduce his power and, in effect, to transfer power to someone else. Now, that then brings us to the individual who, in Ukraine itself, some are suggesting is playing the largest role in this scandal. And that is David Arakhamiya, who is the leader of the Servant of the People faction, in other words, Zelensky's faction, which has the majority position in the Ukrainian parliament. Now, Arakhamiya is an interesting man. He's not actually ethnically Ukrainian. He's Georgian, but he came to Ukraine back in 1992. And he has lived all his adult life in Ukraine, and he studied in Kiev University, and he's fully assimilated into the Ukrainian political system. Anyway, Arakhamiya has also been close to Zelensky in the past. He was Zelensky's chief negotiator in the negotiations with the Russians in spring in the spring of 2022, which led to the drafting and initialing of the Istanbul Agreement of April 2022. And he has been, throughout this time, the leader, the parliamentary leader of Zelensky's faction. However, it's been widely believed that he has also been a rival of Yermak's, and that the two men don't get on, and that Arakamiya basically has long wanted Yermak's job, or at least, if not his job, then at least the influence that Yermak has had over Zelensky and over the political system. And it is not impossible that Arakamiya is at least partly involved in the scandal and in arranging the pressure on Yermak by Nabu and Sapo and all of the other investigations that we have been hearing about. I don't know that it is the case, but it is at least a possibility. And then, of course, there are Zelensky's other enemies, people like Poroshenko and Klitschko, the mayor of Kiev, and others as well. They have been active trying to engineer Zelensky's removal at various times and Poroshenko's return to the post of president, or at least return to a similar position in some form. And of course, there's also been the strange figure, the difficult, complex figure of Zaluzhny, far away in exile, comfortable exile, as ambassador, or ambassador in London, but nonetheless, apparently, still playing some kind of a role in Kiev politics. If this snake pit, which is Kiev, can be described with the more dignified word politics. Anyway, there we go. So all of these people in Kiev might be playing a role here, and they might all be intriguing with each other, and they might all be trying in some way to cut Zelensky down, or ultimately even to replace him. And in order to cut down Zelensky, they would have to get rid of Yermak. And just to say again, these people have agency. They have a role to play in Ukraine, or are playing a role in Ukraine. It's not inconceivable that they have their friends in Nabu and Sapo. I am sure that Poroshenko, for example, does. And it could be that some of the people in Nabu and Sapo are acting on the behalf of these various factions rather than at the bidding of the United States. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss this further. I am not someone who knows very much about the snake bit in Kiev. If you want to read about it, go to, as I said, to Strana. And events in Ukraine covers this thing, this sort of thing, really very well. It's easy, I think, when talking about Yermak's fall, to miss the bigger picture. Whoever was behind it, the Americans, Arakamiya, Poroshenko and Klitschko, Budanov, others are suggesting him, whoever ultimately was behind it, perhaps all of them in combination with behind it together. The key thing to understand is that the Zelensky regime is unraveling. After Donald Trump, or rather after Witkoff and Kushner presented their 28-point plan, there was, as I said, a brief moment of stabilization. Kiev was shocked that the plan, altogether about the plan, nobody in Kiev wanted to see it implemented. There was a kind of rally round Zelensky. The European Union was shocked as well, and they told their friends in Kiev. Bring this all to a stop, put it on hold. We don't want trouble at the moment when the Russians are advancing and the Americans are making proposals that we don't like. But that brief moment of stabilization, which included Zelensky having a showdown with Arakhamiya and his parliamentary faction, and telling them categorically that Yermak and the other person who's close to Zelensky and who's also under investigation, Umerov, Yermak and Umerov, stay. Anyway, that moment of stabilization has passed, and the crisis has deepened, and it's taken another turn. And it's not just a crisis for Zelensky, but it's a symptom of the broader crisis which is facing Ukraine. For one thing, losing Yermak is also a way, if you like, of Yermak himself departing the scene. If there are investigators coming after him, if Yermak himself is perhaps starting to worry that the Russians are going to close in on Kiev before long, well, he doesn't want to be in Kiev for much longer, and it's his way, of course, also to get out. But one way or the other, the key thing to understand is that this corruption crisis could not be taking place if there was not a broader crisis affecting the whole of Ukraine. If it didn't seem as if the front lines in Ukraine are weeks or months at most from full collapse, if there wasn't clear signs that the United States has come to the conclusion, or at least some important people in the United States have come to the important conclusion that the war is lost, and if in Europe the political and financial pressures were now escalating to the point where it seems as if in a few weeks or months' time, the money flow to Ukraine might cease. Now, there's been a long article about this whole situation in the Financial Times. It came out yesterday, and the article is about Ursula's and Merz's plan to give Ukraine a 140 billion euro loan using the frozen Russian assets held by Euroclear, which are the Russian central bank's assets, as collateral. Now, the Belgian Prime Minister, Bart De Wever, has apparently written a letter which strongly opposes this entire proposal. In fact, according to the Financial Times, which has seen this letter, De Wever in the letter says that Ursula's and Merz's proposal is fundamentally wrong. And he says so, basing his views on what the chief executive of Euroclear has said, that the whole plan looks legally dubious and could fail in a court with catastrophic consequences for Euroclear if that were to happen. Now, to repeat again, if something like that were to happen, it would be Euroclear itself that would be sued by the Russians, not necessarily in a European court, perhaps in an Asian court. And of course, these comments by the chief executive of Euroclear would inevitably be seen by any judge hearing that case as an admission by Euroclear about the fact that this entire scheme, the scheme that Ursula and Merz have cobbled together, is illegal. And in the letter, according to the Financial Times, De Wever warns that any rapid finalisation of the plan to fund Ukraine could wreck the chances of a potential peace deal, which is, of course, hardly a real objection, because Ursula and Merz want to wreck a peace deal. But then he gets, apparently, to the heart of the matter. And this is what the Financial Times says. In his letter, De Wever says, hastily moving forward on the proposed reparations loan scheme would have as collateral damage that we, as the EU, are effectively preventing reaching an eventual peace deal. In other words, that doing this would anger Donald Trump. That's the subtext beneath that sentence. Trump would blame the Europeans for wrecking his peace initiative with Moscow. And then De Wever continues, as a precondition for Belgium to support this plan, EU member states must provide Euroclear with binding commitments to cover the 185 billion euros of Russian assets held at the depository should the loan go sour, which of course it will, as everybody knows, or sanctions against Russian assets be lifted. EU countries must sign up to legally binding, and these words are in apparently the letter. This is a direct quote from the letter. Legally binding, unconditional, irrevocable, on demand, joint and several guarantees in relation to the 158 billion euros by the time of the leaders' summit in Brussels in December. Now, that is extraordinary demand. Legally binding, so they can't resile from it. Unconditional, irrevocable, so they can't say at some point, well, we've changed our minds and we're going to pull out of this. On demand, and then perhaps the most powerful and the most alarming for the Europeans of all, joint and several guarantees. Now, joint and several liability is a concept very well known to lawyers. It means that when a group of people or companies or businesses take on joint liability for some kind of scheme, guarantee a scheme together, each one of them separately commits themselves to paying the full amount of the guarantee if called upon. So, it would not be the case, for example, that if the Russians came after Euroclear and Euroclear lost the case and the Russians wanted the 185 billion euros back and the 185 billion euros were no longer there to give them, it would not be the case that Euroclear would go to each and every single European country one by one and ask them, can you please provide us with a proportion of this money? Euroclear would be able to go to each and every European member state and ask each one to pay the full 185 billion euros. So they could come to Merz and they'd say, this was your crazy idea, now we've lost the case. Germany, please give us 185 billion euros. Or they could go to Macron in France and they would say, look, it was you supported this idiotic idea, give us 185 billion euros. Or they could go across the border to the Netherlands and they could ask the Netherlands for 185 billion euros. They could go to any country in the European Union and they could ask that country to provide the full amount. And then it would be for that country, after it had paid the full 185 billion euros to Euroclear, to then go after all of the other co-guarantors in order to get from them payment of their share of the guarantee. So let's assume it's Germany, and of course it is Germany that is the country that Deveva undoubtedly has in mind. If it's Germany that gets landed with this entire bill, then what Merz would have to do is he'd have to knock on the doors of all the co-guarantors, France, Italy, the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, whichever, and would have to get them to agree to pay a proportion of the 185 billion euros to Germany to make up the difference. Everybody would be on the hook, but one party would be on the hook immediately. They would have to pay unconditionally, irrevocably, on demand, according to De Weber's letter. And as the Financial Times points out, the letter is so similar in its language and in its views to those of the chief executive of Euroclear, which I discussed in a recent programme, that I cannot help but think that Euroclear has played an instrumental role in drafting this letter. And De Weber, according to the Financial Times, in this letter also said that other EU countries must agree to share the financial burden of any legal proceedings arising from the loan. So if there's a court case in, say, Singapore, the European Union must pay the legal fees, not just Belgium, and not just Euroclear. And De Weber also demanded that any frozen assets held in any other EU countries must be used for the loan, must be used for the loan as well. So coming back to his initial point, this whole idea is fundamentally wrong, and it is so wrong that he clearly expects, as does Euroclear, that in any court case they're going to lose, and therefore they want Germany, in effect, to give an unconditional guarantee to cover the entire loan, and it would then be left to Germany, for Germany, if this all were to go wrong and Euroclear were to lose the court case, which it almost certainly would. In fact, I have to say this, given all that's been said and written by now, I'm not even sure that Euroclear intends to defend the court case if it is ever brought. I can very easily imagine that Euroclear, in order to limit the reputational damage and the costs, would simply admit the case, plead force majeure, in other words, that it was strong-armed into doing it by the European Union, and then invoke the guarantee, getting Germany to pay. So, anyway, De Weber says this is all fundamentally wrong. And I have to say this, letter sounds, from what the Financial Times is saying, as so strong that I don't myself think now that this whole scheme is going to crystallise, that this is ever going to happen. Is Merz going to put Germany on the hook for 185 billion euros? So, coming back to the mood in Kiev, they must have some inkling of some of this. Some of them, of course, read the Financial Times. That article came out yesterday, by the way, but it's likely that people in Kiev were being tipped off about the situation previously by people in the EU, that Euroclear and the Belgians were digging in their heels. And the obstacles now look overwhelming and impossible to get round, so that this 140 billion euro loan therefore isn't coming. So there must be at least worries in Kiev, panic in Kiev, that the Russians are coming and the money from Europe is drying up, And the Americans increasingly are saying, Driscoll said it when he was in Kiev to the Ukrainians, look, you've lost the war and we are not going to be able to come to your rescue. And I can absolutely see how this would be a galvanizing moment in Ukraine, in Kiev, that the political class there would say to themselves, it's all about to fall apart. Let's do desperately whatever we can. Perhaps if we bring Zelensky down to earth, he might be able to cobble something together with Trump and the Europeans. Or maybe if we get Poroshenko in, he's got good relations with many of the European leaders. They were not happy when he lost the election and got replaced with Zelensky. Maybe they will be happier to give him money than they are to Zelensky at the moment. And if none of those things happen, well, let's at least get all of these people out of the way so that we can fill up our own suitcases as quickly as possible. Because who knows, maybe in February, maybe in March, maybe in May or June, we are going to have to bolt. And the moment has come, therefore, given that the writing is on the wall, to fill up the suitcases before that moment comes. So I can completely see how, with the walls closing in, the Ukrainians might be, some people in Kiev might be saying to themselves, this is the moment. This is the moment when we have to strike. We have to begin to take the action against Zelensky, and that this may be what has provoked or precipitated the events of the last few days. But to repeat again, this is a symptom of collapse. None of this would be happening if we were not looking at a catastrophic situation. If the Russians weren't advancing, if the money from Europe was not drying up, if the Americans were not having publicly expressed doubts. And of course, if we're talking about the last two, the major reason why the money from Europe is not coming, the major reason why the Americans are having doubts, is because of the first, because the Russians are coming, because the Russians are advancing. In any kind of crisis, in any crisis of this kind, you will see that there is this enormous, frenetic, last spasm of, if you want to call it political activity, well, do so, in the capital, even as events move faster towards the inevitable fall. It is true, in place after place I can think of, why, even in Berlin in 1945, in fact, little known, a group of men who were involved in the German leader's bodyguard before the crash managed to go round to the Reichsbank, the German central bank, and walked off with much of the gold that was stored there. It's the sort of thing, as I said, that tends to happen in capitals like Kiev in the days and weeks and months before the collapse, the final moment of collapse comes. And this is the true message, in my opinion, behind the fall of Yermak. We're seeing that the fears, the doubts in Kiev are growing, the panic is increasing, and what looked just a few months ago as an impregnable government, Zelensky's government looked impregnable when there was some talk a few months ago after the events in February, the quarrel in the Oval Office between Trump and Vance and Zelensky, when there was some talk of Zelensky being pushed out. Not only did Zelensky manage to hold on, but in fact, there was no one at that time, despite inquiries, public inquiries made by some people from the United States looking for alternatives. No one came forward at that time to challenge Zelensky because his position and Ukraine's position looked stable, whereas, as we see now, it is different. The situation is different. Everybody can see that the collapse is coming, and that is what is causing the instability in Kiev now. Now, having said all of this, where does actually this take us? It could be, and Strana acknowledges the possibility, that the situation could escalate to the point where Zelensky actually falls. And it says that whilst in theory a weakened Zelensky might be more susceptible to US pressure regarding the peace agreement, by the way, it's equally possible that he's going to take an even harder line, and we'll discuss that in a moment. But anyway, Strana acknowledges that it cannot be ruled out that the system of power will completely collapse and become unmanageable, leaving no one to negotiate peace terms with. This could have catastrophic consequences for the military situation, and therefore the Ukrainian elite and the West will try to prevent it. And that is true. But it's not impossible. And Strana floats this possibility in connection with a potential Zelensky resignation if the investigations start to close on him. And as I've discussed in many programs, Zelensky is the one figure within the Ukrainian system who has at least notional legitimacy in the eyes of the West and in the eyes of the political class. I appreciate that Putin regularly says that the Speaker of the Parliament, who, by the way, would become acting president, as I understand it, if Zelensky did step down, that he would have greater legitimacy than Zelensky does. But I don't think anybody in Kiev takes this person especially seriously. And for the record, nothing this person has ever said has suggested to me that he is any more willing to compromise with the Russians than Zelensky himself has been, just saying. But anyway, I cannot imagine that in an atmosphere of this kind of crisis, this person, if he were to become acting president, would be able to exercise authority for very long. And given the immense difficulties of organizing elections, it's indeed possible that a Zelensky resignation, indeed highly likely that a Zelensky resignation, would merely accelerate the collapse, with all of the various factions in Kiev fighting each other, battling with each other, and each of them trying to take with them as much as they can, so that they have something before the walls close in and they have to get out. So anyway, that's my take on this. Now, Zelensky himself says that he is going to appoint a new chief of staff before very long. We'll see who that is. But he has probably made the situation in Ukraine even more fractious and unstable by announcing that Rustem Umerov, who is also under investigation by NABU, is going to take Yermak's place as Ukraine's chief negotiator in the coming meeting with Witkoff and Kushner in Miami. And he's announced who will lead the Ukrainian delegation to these talks, and it is actually quite a strong delegation. I noticed that Budanov is a member. There was some speculation at one point that Budanov would actually lead this delegation, but he has not done so. Anyway, we are told that the delegation will consist of advisor to the head of the presidential office, Alexander Bevs. He clearly is one of Yermak's team. He's still there. Defense Intelligence Chief Kirill Budanov, Chief of the General Staff Andrei Gnatov, Foreign Intelligence Service Chief Oleg Ivashchenko, Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Kislytskaya, and the National Security and Defense Council Deputy Secretary Yevgen Ostryansky, Deputy Chairman of the Security Service of Ukraine, Oleksandr Poklad. So it's heavy with intelligence and security officers and military people. And this delegation, which will be headed by Umerov, is now heading to Miami to meet Kushner and Witkoff and to discuss the plan or points of discussion that Kushner and Witkoff are going to take with them to Moscow for their make or break meeting with Putin. Now, Putin has made time to meet them. We had an announcement yesterday of the date of Putin's trip to India, and it will happen not on the 3rd of December, but on the 4th of December. So that does give slightly more time. I'm guessing that that means that Kushner and Witkoff and perhaps Driscoll will be traveling to Moscow at the start of next week, perhaps on Sunday or Monday, and could be meeting Putin and the other Russian officials fairly quickly. And Putin, of course, has already spoken about the fact that what he's been presented with are simply points of discussion, and the Russians will put together a team, and the team will include people from the foreign ministry, as Putin explained in his press conference that I discussed yesterday, and Medinsky and Ushakov. And by the way, thanks to the person who informed me about the correct way to pronounce Ushakov's name. Medinsky, who heads the negotiating team that has been negotiating with the Ukrainians, and Ushakov will both be part of the Russian negotiating team also. Now, Bloomberg has a rather interesting take on this whole process. It says that the Americans have decided basically to cut Europe completely out of the negotiations. That there was this meeting in Geneva, that there were some talks there, but that the Americans have decided to stick with most of their original ideas, retreat by Ukraine from Donbass, surrender of Donbass, Ukraine outside NATO, all of those things. And they understand that if they were to walk back on that part of the American proposals and points of discussion, the whole negotiation in Moscow would collapse almost immediately. Of course, what Bloomberg won't say, and what no part of the Western media wants to acknowledge, is that the Americans ultimately cannot pull back from these points because they committed themselves to them in their talks with the Russians that took place in August when Witkoff visited Moscow, and most specifically when Putin met Trump in Anchorage. That was the point when the United States accepted that the Ukrainians would have to retreat from Donbass and that Ukraine would have to stay permanently outside NATO. And no doubt much else was discussed also. the Russians have made it clear that they do expect some formal recognition of the four regions, as well as Crimea, as part of Russia. But given the agreement with Russia that has already been made, it's impossible for the Americans to pull back from that, because if they do, then the Russians will come back and say, well, this is nothing to, this is, bears no relation to what we previously agreed. We're not interested. Go away. We will continue with the war. And the outcome of that, you know perfectly well, as do we. So the Americans have less room to negotiate with the Russians than I think some people in Europe, and certainly in the media, want to understand. Just say. Anyway, that's the rumour and that is the speculation. We'll have to wait and see what actually happens. The Europeans are seething and furious about this. They are immensely angry that they have been sidelined. Anatole Levin, by the way, as I've never forgotten, in an article he wrote in Responsible Statecraft months and months ago, said that in order for this negotiation process to proceed to any kind of satisfactory conclusion, the Americans need to cut the Europeans completely out, because the Europeans are in far too hysterical and intransigent a mood to allow negotiations to proceed. And Alex Cristoforo and I, by the way, made that same point just a few months before, in August 2024, when we said that we didn't think that it made much sense for the United States to involve itself in negotiations anyway, precisely because the obstruction from Europe, from within Europe, and from the neocons and their allies in the United States would be too strong. But anyway, that's apparently where we are. The Europeans are very upset and very angry about this. Kaya Kallas has recently taken to saying that over the course of the last century, the Russians have attacked 19 countries without provocation, sometimes more than once. I am completely unable to understand what she's talking about. Larry Johnson has given a good article, written a good article about all of this on Sonar 21. From what I understood Kaya Kallas to say, nobody has attacked Russia during this period, which, given what happened during the Second World War, is would be remarkable, would be really not remarkable, would be absolutely staggering if she did actually say that. Anyway, I noticed that Kaya Kallas's words were repeated with approval by Patrick Winter, who is the chief foreign news editor in The Guardian. And, well, as I said, I find that absolutely bizarre. But anyway, that gives one a sense of how angry and upset the Europeans are about this whole process. It takes restating, however, that the Russians have already made it clear, have made it very clear already, that there is no agreement or draft agreement in existence. There's only a series of discussion points that the Americans have put together based on what they agreed with the Russians in Alaska. And the Russians have said that they are prepared to negotiate about them in detail, but the Russians expect that this will be a detailed negotiation between properly constituted negotiating teams. As I discussed in my program yesterday, Putin, over the course of his press conference in Bishkek, said that he knows of no other way to conduct successfully negotiations of this kind. And that's what the Russians are going to insist on. And what that probably means is that when Witkoff and Kushner and Driscoll and perhaps Rubio should be there, turn up in Moscow at the start of next week, the Russians will say to them, right, fine, we're prepared to work with this. This is a useful selection of good discussion points. This is the moment, therefore, why we need to get negotiations, proper negotiations between us and you, between Russia and the United States, up and running. We're going to appoint our negotiating team, Lavrov or Ryabkov or someone like that from the foreign ministry is going to lead it. We suggest Istanbul as the obvious location. We already have negotiations ongoing with the Ukrainians there. Medinsky and Ushakov will be part of our negotiating team. All that remains, therefore, is for you to appoint yours. That, I suspect, is what's going to come out of the trip to Moscow. And the reason I think it's going to be Istanbul, by the way, is not just because this is where the Russians and the Ukrainians have already been meeting and holding discussions, but because yesterday there were reports that Sergei Naryshkin, who is the head of Russia's chief intelligence agency, the SVR, went to Turkey, and I've seen claims that he met President Erdogan himself, and I suspect that the Russians are discussing with Erdogan arrangements for Istanbul to become the location of the big negotiations, this time between America and Russia, which will come. Once upon a time, negotiations of this sort would have taken place in a European capital, in Helsinki, or in Geneva. There is still an outside chance that they might happen in Budapest, but given the way in which the Europeans have been behaving, I can't help but think that they're more likely to happen in Turkey. This despite the fact that Orban had a meeting with Putin yesterday in the Kremlin. It's a lengthy meeting. They discussed many economic issues, and of course they discussed peace in Ukraine. And I understand that Orban pushed hard for Budapest to be the location where the talks take place. Well, we shall see. Anyway, that's the situation with the diplomacy. Now, again, this leaves less time to deal with the military situation. And this is unfortunate. There's been what might be an act of major escalation. So two tankers that were crossing the Black Sea, heading for the Russian port of Novorossiysk. I understand both of them, flying flags of African countries, suffered significant damage in the Black Sea. And I get the sense that one of them at least has sunk. It's important to say that though they are tankers, they were not carrying oil. They were apparently intending to tank up in Novorossiysk for whichever location, destination they were eventually going to go to. The Turkish authorities have suggested that this was the result of external action, and the Western media is claiming that these ships, these two tankers, struck mines. Now, that is not impossible. There are mines in the Black Sea, apparently mostly laid by Ukraine at the start of the war. A lot of the mines are supposed to have been cleared, but it's not impossible that some of them are still floating around and might have struck ships and might have done damage. But the Russian media space is full of allegations that, in fact, the tankers were not struck by mines at all, that they were attacked by Ukrainian drones. And there are even stories of two Ukrainian boats that left harbor in Ukraine, and which were probably used to launch and pilot the drones which attacked these ships. Now, that would make it a deliberate attack on these two tankers, and that would be a massive escalation. It would be a criminal act. It would be an attack on the high seas. I'm not an expert in this area, but I would guess that this would constitute, by the way, an act of piracy. Just saying. An act of this kind on the high seas. But of course, if it were seen by the Russians and by others as some kind of an attempt by Ukraine to impose some kind of physical blockade on Russian oil exports through the Black Sea, then it is overwhelmingly likely, it would almost overwhelmingly likely provoke a very, very strong Russian reaction and a major escalation by Moscow. And of course, it would also lose Ukraine more friends around the world. Now, the fact that this attack has happened at this particular time and in this particular way could be because orders were given a few weeks ago and the Ukrainian special services were still acting to those orders. But of course, there must be the suspicion that it was done in order to provoke the Russians into doing something that would put in jeopardy the entire movement towards negotiating peace. Anyway, let's discuss other things that happened last night. Last night, the Russians conducted another gigantic missile and drone strike on Kiev itself. Now, I have no clear information about the effect of this strike, though I understand it was as big as any of the others that have taken place up to now. I've seen some video footage of drones and missiles striking targets across Kiev. The Russian Defense Ministry has given its own account of this attack, which tells us only a certain amount. It says, in response to terrorist attacks launched by Ukraine against civilian facilities on the territory of Russia, well, they always say that, the armed forces of Russia carried out a massive strike with high-precision weapons tonight, as well as with drones against enterprises of the Ukrainian defense industry and energy infrastructure that supports its operation. The goals of the strike were achieved. All the assigned targets were engaged. Well, that's what the Defence Ministry tells us, but it doesn't tell us very much. I will obviously return to this topic tomorrow, the topic of this strike tomorrow. For the record, though, I didn't see any sign in the footage of this strike that I have seen of Ukrainian air defence coming into operation. Anyway, on the front lines, the situation continues as before. In other words, the Russians continue to advance. Now, there has been growing alarm and some anger in Ukraine about the situation in Gulyapolye. There are reports that a Ukrainian brigade that was defending Gulyapolye has basically broken with the soldiers, its soldiers, fleeing from their positions, firstly in villages that were located to the east of Gulyapolye, and then from Gulyapolye itself. There are further reports that the Ukrainians have rushed more experienced and tougher troops to Gulyapolye to try to stem the ongoing collapse, but that they are massively outnumbered by the Russians, that the Russians have captured significant parts of Gulyapolye, and that fighting is now taking place in the very centre of the town, and that the Russians are likely to capture Gulyapolye within the next couple of days. Now, things like this have happened before. Ocheretino, in the spring of 2024, was captured by the Russians, also following a collapse of Ukrainian resistance somewhat like this. In the summer, late summer of 2024, a town called Novogrodivka also fell to the Russians in a similar way. Back in, I think it was May 2022, the Russians captured the town of Liman near Slavyansk, where fighting is now again taking place, again against basically no Ukrainian opposition. Ukrainian troops were supposed to have fled Liman at that time. But of course, those were isolated events at a time when the situation on the front lines was less critical in some ways than it is now. And if there has indeed been a collapse in Guliapolye, well, it will have enormous consequences, but it could also be a sign of things to come. Anyway, we will see. Further west, there were reports last night that the Russians have now captured the whole of the town of Novogrodivka, which lies immediately to the south of the great city of Zaporozhye. Anyway, elsewhere, the fighting continues too. The Russians I've noticed that the Russian Defense Ministry has now started to publish interviews of Russian soldiers fighting in the Pokrovsk Cauldron area. When they started to do that with the fighting in Kupiansk, it was a clear sign that the battle was coming to an end. And I suspect the same is true with the Pokrovsk Cauldron. So maybe it will collapse now over the course of the coming week. We shall see. And further to the north and east, the situation in Siversk, Liman, looks to be as terrible as ever. And there is now more and more discussion and talk about an encirclement of Liman and also of Siversk too. Anyway, I will discuss the military situation in more detail tomorrow, when I will hopefully also have a lot more information about the missile strike. But to repeat again, the Russians not only are advancing, but it is the fact of their advance. It is the crumbling condition of Ukraine's army, which is precipitating this latest diplomatic effort by the United States to save what can be saved in Ukraine. And it is also what lies behind the political crisis in Kiev and the Zelensky regime's unravelling. We're not at the end. We still have some way to go, but the end is in sight now. It may take a while. I wonder how difficult and protracted and complex the negotiations between the Americans and the Russians are going to turn out to be. I wonder how stable the situation in Kiev is going to continue to be. But the only question now is whether the Russians ultimately prefer to stop at some point where something of Ukraine is preserved, perhaps all of Ukraine west of the Dnieper, and whether that can be negotiated, or whether the Russians are going to conclude that the negotiations are not addressing their concerns and that it makes more sense for them to continue to fight and go on till the very end. Anyway, that's where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar. Links under this video. Please also remember to go to our shop. And last but not least, please also remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel if you've liked this programme.